Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Martyrs and Missionaries is a production of Revive Studios.
You're listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise, and in every episode, I'll bring you a new martyr and or missionary, the called and the brave. In this episode, we're covering the life of Helen Rosevere, medical missionary to the Belgian Congo. All right, we're just going to dive in right here because Helen Rosevere's story is one that I've gotten requests for a couple of years now, and I'm excited to do it. And I didn't know much about her before preparing this episode, and so I found her two-part autobiography is very helpful. The first one is called Give Me This Mountain, and the second one is called He Gave Us a Valley. And so I will link those in the episode description. You can also get them on Archive, Library Archive, Internet Archive, that's what it is. You can get it there. And this episode does have to come with a content warning, because it's important to know that Helen was a victim of sexual assault, and therefore that will be discussed in this episode. So if you are listening with younger kids, this is a heads up for you. Helen Rosevere was born in Hertfordshire, England in 1925, and for my map people, that's about an hour northwest of London. For those of you who are in England, you probably already knew that, but just in case. Her father, Martin, was a mathematician responsible for creating the ration books for England during the Second World War, and her older brother, Bob, was recruited by Alan Turing to work as a codebreaker at Bletchley Park, which was the premier location of Allied codebreakers who were working to crack the Nazi Enigma machine. So all in all, she comes from pretty humble beginnings we can all really relate to. But I say this because, number one, it's cool, and number two, because it gives a little bit of an insight as to why she has such high standards for herself, as we'll see going through the episode here. Her family hailed from a high Anglican background, or what she referred to as an Anglo-Catholic background. I tried to figure out what the difference between that and traditional Catholicism was, and I really couldn't see much of a difference. Maybe they're more Reformed. But she describes how she loved the ritualism of it and the beauty in the hymns and the incense and the repetition because it all felt really reassuring. And she wrote that on her 8th birthday during an evening Sunday school lesson where the teacher talked about India, that she decided she wanted to grow up and become a missionary to tell other little boys and girls about Jesus. She said it was a child's determination that never faded. And in the 3 years that followed, she had the opportunity to go on summer holidays with her godfather, who took them to the most exciting places, including the Berlin Olympics in 1936. And when she went to boarding school at the age of 12, she said she felt this urgent need to impress, to be loved, to be wanted. She writes further, a need that grew steadily stronger through these formative years. My vivid imagination found plenty of food for exaggeration in all the experiences of recent holidays, magnifying out of all proportion the happenings and personalities. I boasted of my introduction to Hitler at the Olympic Games in Berlin, weaving truth that we had seen Hitler at the lighting of the torch, and fiction that I was introduced to him so cleverly that I myself had failed to remember where one ended and the other started. Linked with all of this, there was a funny sort of feeling in the back of my mind that I had been sent to boarding school because I wasn't wanted at home. I do not think now that this was true or fair to my parents, but these are things that eat their way into a child's mind. It became a must to be popular, to impress. I was hungry to be loved and wanted, and yet I just wasn't that type. And so I lied and magnified still further my fabulous stories, and it didn't work. In fact, it had precisely the opposite effect, and I found myself more unwanted than ever before. Something you'll see throughout her books is that Helen describes herself in a very unflattering way, and this is both refreshing in the sense that she didn't attempt to hide any of her flaws or inner thoughts, but I also think that she judged herself maybe a little bit too harshly. She had this drive to succeed and impress that she seemed to struggle with all of her life, and then this compounded with her strong-willed nature, a nature that is arguably needed for a place like the Congo during these days, but this caused her to carry a lot of guilt, and you will see that as we carry on. During all of this, she says that she began to think more seriously about God, who he was, and what he meant to her, and she decided, along with several other students, to go through the confirmation process. And she wasn't sure that it meant much, but it was her way of stumbling nearer to God. And I like how she puts it here, and I think this rings true for a lot of us. She says, God knew and accepted and leaned towards me to draw me steadily nearer to himself. I wasn't converted, it's true, but I'm not sure that God is as interested as we sometimes seem to be in all the precise order of the steps which lead to true conversion. At any rate, God drew near to me in it all because he knew that my decision to be confirmed indicated a search for him, for someone bigger than myself, someone I could draw on and depend on, someone to deal with all my complicated needs, all the complexes and worries that burdened my heart. She later had another moment of drawing near to God, but it was still shrouded in this love for the ritual pietism of going regularly to Mass and confession. And upon leaving the church, she would immediately feel empty and hopeless, and she started going to the cinema just so that she wouldn't have to be alone with her own thoughts. She went every weeknight and twice on Saturdays. She would even watch the same film twice if nothing else was showing. I do think it is important to note the historical backdrop of her adolescence because it explains at least where some of these feelings of wanting to forget it all came from, because she was 13 when the war started, 14 when the Blitz, or the 8-month-long sustained bombing campaign against Britain, happened, 17 when the V1 doodlebug Bob started dropping, and 18 when the V2s came along a few months before the end of the war. All in all, almost 70,000 civilians were killed in Britain during the bombings, and she gives a snapshot of what life was like during those days. It was the time of the V1 doodlebugs, and everyone was tense and fearful. There was little chattering in the streets and shops. When the siren alerted us of an approaching raid, everyone hurried quickly onto their own business. Then someone caught the high whine of a V1 and stood still looking up. The action was infectious. We almost felt the very traffic stand still and draw in its breath, and all of London waited. The whine grew, faces were strained, each one knew we should make for shelters, but we had done it too often, and even shelters were not good proof against these new weapons. A fascination was on us. Suddenly there was a sharp silence, a great pause hung in the air, then an explosion, a rumble, and a gentle sigh caught up and multiplied as each walker hurried on his way, secretly ashamed of the first thought, I'm safe this time. The urgency of self-preservation amidst all the fear and uncertainty almost pushed into second place the thought, poor beggars, I wonder who got that one. She finished school in July of 1944 and entered Newnham College at Cambridge to study to become a doctor. They had this wartime measure in place, which allowed students to become a doctor in 2 years by working straight through the summers, which led to a lot of exhaustion and overwork, but it was possible. And when she arrived, she was overwhelmed by a sense of imposter syndrome, the feeling that she didn't belong here. What was she even thinking? And in her dorm room, she found a note attached to her mirror, which said that if she had nowhere to go after supper, to come to my room at 8 p.m. for coffee. And it was signed by a girl named Dorothy, who attached also her room number. She was especially nervous knocking on the door, only to have it open to a flush-faced Dorothy trying pitifully to start a fire in the fireplace, and instead creating this smoking mess. And the goofiness of that first interaction helped to break down the barriers, and she and Dorothy became friends. She then joined the cricket team and made fast friends with that year's captain. And then soon she had a little posse going and was determined to start fresh, leaving old anxieties behind. On certain days, Dorothy and some of the others wouldn't join them on their outings, and they learned that it was because there was a prayer group on those nights. And Helen decided to join and was amazed as they opened Ephesians 3 and read it together, readily discussing it afterwards. She started attending regularly and then spending the whole first term going to these Christian Union meetings, to attending services morning and evening at the Anglo-Catholic Church. And as she began to draw nearer to the evangelical meetings and it was noticed by her old church, they sent people to talk her out of it, basically, to tell her of the authority of the church, of the sacraments, of confession, on the historical significance of the church and of tradition. And it just didn't ring true to her as it once had. But then they sent her beloved pastor, and that's when she dived once more back in with renewed fervor, although her attention was now divided because in addition to going to these different meetings, she was also attending the communist meetings drawn in by her friendship with their leader, Olga. It was Mass in the morning, communism in the afternoon, and evangelical meetings in the evenings. And her evangelical friends didn't call her out or judge her, but they continued to extend friendship. During the winter break, she was invited to a series of Christian meetings happening outside of the city. There would be addresses, prayer, and Bible study. And she was so anxious to get out of the dorm, and so she agreed to go. And she was learning a lot and really enjoying herself until the group devolved into arguments about denominational differences. She was nonchalant until some of them began to push back on the idea of transubstantiation or the presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Some of them teased her and asked how she could be truly converted if she was such a Romanist at heart. She stormed off to her room, ashamed at being goaded into an argument and losing her temper. She wrote, "My mind went back through that week and all its teachings, through the past term and the multitudes of new influences and new friendships, back to my home and family and childhood. Suddenly, I flung myself on my bed in a flood of tears and loneliness. With an overwhelming sense of failure and helplessness, I cried out to God, if there was a God, to meet with me and to make utterly real and vital to me himself. I raised my eyes and through my tears read a text on the wall, 'Be still and know that I am God.' That was all, and immediately the whole burden fell away in a moment. Be still and know God, whose name I am. Be still and know him. Stop going to this one and that. Stop striving to understand with intellect. Just be still and know him." In that moment, a great flood of peace and joy and unutterable happiness flooded in, and I knew that he and I had entered into a new relationship. I knew God in that moment, that all the theories were true, and somehow he would work them out for me. The steady reading of scripture in the previous months, the careful listening to doctrinal teachings both at the house party and in Christian Union meetings had prepared the way. For years, the Holy Spirit had been opening my eyes to a sense of sin, convicting me of my unworthiness before a holy God. But now came the wonderful gift of repentance. God poured out his grace and forgiveness in cleansing from all the uncleanness of sin and in revealing, at this time, the amazing wonder of the friendship of Christ. She went back downstairs to attend the last meeting, and the subject was on testimonies, and she had no idea what that was until it was explained. And no one spoke until she awkwardly blurted out, "I met with God," and then was silent. A veteran Bible teacher was out in the crowd and later wrote in her Bible, Philippians 3:10, "that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto death. He said to me, 'Tonight you've entered into the first part of the verse, that I may know him. This is only the beginning, and there was a long journey ahead. My prayer for you is that you will go on through the verse to know the power of his resurrection, and also, God willing, one day perhaps, the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death.' And so this started for me the thrilling journey of the Christian pilgrimage through this earthly life towards the heavenly eternity." Helen's father and the board of directors at the school were paying for her tuition, so she wrote to tell them that she was now studying medicine to become a missionary and also about her denominational change. She wanted to let them know in case they changed their mind and decided not to support her, but she was assured that they were all very much in support of her vision and would continue to support her. About her decision, she writes, "To be a missionary, I'd known for years that I was going to be a missionary. Would my conversion change this? Did I need some further specific call? I had already, however, signified my intention of serving God abroad by joining the InterVarsity Missionary Fellowship, and the urge in my heart towards overseas missionary service was growing greater, not diminishing. It began to seem to me the obvious Christian duty of one and all. I was puzzled by others' lack of interest in missionary service, their lack of concern for the millions who were in the darkness, who had never heard the love of God." She began to understand the importance of prayer and the liberty of an outpoured heart, and says that God drew very near to her. She also had the help of a mentor who summarized how to know God's will. 1, through daily Bible reading. 2, through private prayer. And 3, through the advice of Christian friends and those with greater experiences. And lastly, peace in each one, in turn individually and together. Let the peace of God umpire in your heart. If he is speaking, he will give peace and silence other voices. I mentioned Olga earlier. She was the head of the Women's Communist Party at the school, as well as the captain of the hockey team or the cricket team, or basically into all kinds of sports. But after Helen's conversion, she had slowly drifted out of the group. And months later, she came by to borrow some hockey equipment from Helen. She was living in such poor housing conditions off campus that Helen offered her a bath and some hot buttered crumpets once she got out. Olga seemed grateful and just a little bit lonely. And when she was invited to mission meetings, she agreed to go. Helen was so invested in her conversion that it took up all her thoughts. They read and studied, with Olga deciding at last that unless God revealed to her heart the assurance of salvation, she would go on not believing. Helen was so wrapped up in Olga's conversion that she says she began to doubt her own faith. How could God fail her? But he didn't, because over the coming weeks, slowly, Olga began to feel the deep assurance of God's love and salvation, and she came quietly to faith and began earnestly studying the Bible and craving time spent among believers and in prayer. Helen goes on to share what happened next. A few weeks later, at the beginning of the Lent term, Princess Ada Desta of Ethiopia came into my room and said that she had just received a letter from the headmistress of Clarendon, her old school, telling her of their urgent need of a matron, as their own had been suddenly taken ill. We got down on our knees and laid this need before the Lord. As we arose, there was a knock at the door. Olga came in and blurted, "I've given up my job. It seems inconsistent with my faith as a Christian. Pray for me that God will show me where he wants me to go and what he wants me to do." Within 10 minutes, we were on the phone to Clarendon to ask if Olga would be suitable as an assistant matron. That weekend, she went up to take up her new duties. It was there at Clarendon that she assisted at the annual China Inland Mission Conference and received her clear call to missionary service. And for many years now, she and her husband, Douglas Abrams, have been teaching and preaching the gospel in Japan. Which is so cool. I read that and I was just like, wow, that's amazing. And I looked up a little bit to try to figure out if there was information on them. There is a little bit. So if you go digging around, they seem to have a very, very long and prosperous time in Japan, but I couldn't find anything specific on much else. But it is super, super cool. I really like that story. But now we switch gears from a mountaintop experience to a valley, because Helen contracted a bout of polio and she was sick for about 5 weeks before she recovered. And then after her recovery, she doubted if she wanted to be a missionary at all. And it seems that while she was sick, which was rather frequently, because there's no use being a classic missionary unless you're chronically ill, she suffered from bouts of depression. And this bout was so severe that she began to doubt the assurance of her salvation. And she was wrestling with the old faith versus works debate and how this all ties in with grace. And she began to feel deep guilt for sins which she felt she'd excused. And she no longer had easy access to friends who could help her work through things or to get out of her own head, because she had finished at Cambridge and was now working at the West London Hospital, which didn't have the same fellowship opportunities. She was going through the motions of her faith, but without any feeling, and it was all kind of perfunctory. And she acknowledges that part of her mental state could be attributed to the strain and overwork, which were caused by the high demands of the hospital. But she thought that this physical exhaustion meant spiritual failure. And how did she decide to deal with all of this perceived failure? She decided to throw herself even more into ministry, to teaching others to hopefully convince herself. And I won't go into all the ministry efforts that she went into, but she went into a lot. It was overwhelming just to read about it. And at some point during all of this, she became aware of the Worldwide Evangelization for Christ mission, which was founded by C.T. Studd. And if you want to learn more about his missionary life, I will link his episode in the description. But she decided that she just had to go there and join in the mission life, even while studying to become a doctor at the West London Hospital. And she found it to be a hotbed of spirituality in a good way. She loved it, and she tried to get some of that to bleed into her own life, but she still found herself cold and detached. She writes, "Looking back, it is easy to smile at the intensity of feeling and also the excessive introspection, yet how extremely real it all was at the time. I readily grant that chronic introspection of this type can become very unhealthy, mentally as well as spiritually. As it has often been said, a carrot cannot grow if it is being continually dug up to see how it is getting on. Nervous individuals can make themselves chronically ill by taking their temperature 4 times a day and noting each little rise and fall. Likewise, persistent introspection can work one up into a highly tense state of spiritual sickness. Each conviction of sin was good only insofar as it led me to trust the only one who can deal with sin. But if the sense of failure only made me more acutely conscious of my own miserable state, it had achieved nothing. The Lord allowed me a growing realization of failure in each of these different realms mentioned in order that he himself might fill the vacuum. He longed that I would become more preoccupied with him and less with myself." I like what she says there because, number one, it's really true. You can just work yourself into such a tizzy by thinking way too much on yourself and your problems and sins. It can start in a good place, but if you don't allow it to be an outworking to change, then it serves no purpose, and then you just become rather unfit for ministry. You're no good to anybody. So introspection, good. Chronic introspection, bad. When the time came to complete her exams to become a doctor, she passed part one and then failed part two, which meant that she couldn't test again for another 6 months. But in that time, a couple came back from the Congo with medical needs, and she spent those months caring for them and hearing about the needs of the Congo. Now you hear that and you think, oh, this is the moment, right? It's not at all. She had no desire at this point to go to the Congo. In fact, after she passed her exams to become a doctor and transitioned into a candidate for the WEC for missionary service, she formed a deep friendship with another candidate. She says that she found herself rushing home so that she could hang out with her friend, and the other senior staff saw this codependency form and decided to separate them. And a few weeks later, the other girl went off to the Far East, and Helen says a giant blank space filled her life. She wanted to join her friend in the same area, but the staff said no, and she was content with their decision. But where was she supposed to go? Because every week, a new missionary came around with desperate needs, especially for a doctor. So how would she know where to go? One day, she was ripping the date off of a block calendar and saw the verse from 2 Chronicles, "Repair the house of the Lord." This is kind of a strange verse, she thought. So she shoved it into her pocket and then kind of forgot about it. But 2 days later, she received a letter from an old friend who had become a Christian in recent years, which she didn't know. But this friend had included the same verse from the same block calendar and felt very strongly that she should send it to Helen. But she couldn't figure out what the Lord was trying to tell her. She knew something was happening, but what? Not a clue. Now, the next day at morning prayers, the leader of the leprosy unit of their mission held up the same verse from the same slip of calendar paper and announced that the Lord had burdened her to pray for the Congolese leprosy unit. There were 1,500 leprosy patients, and over 250,000 people relying on them for medical care. It was their oldest mission, and in more than 30 years, they had never had an actual doctor. This was the breach in the wall that needed to be fixed, and the one which God had called Helen to. So a couple of months later in June, the staff were meeting together to decide the fate of 5 candidates, whether they would be accepted by the mission for service or not, and Helen is one of these candidates. Now, all the staff is meeting in this room off to the side somewhere, but Helen finds herself in that hallway. She's carrying trays or something, and she happens to overhear what they think of her, and she can't turn around fast enough. They thought she was proud, a know-it-all, unable to tolerate correction, difficult to live with, etc., etc. And so she ran from the building, bright red and ashamed, and she decided, I guess, to hang up sheets. So she starts hanging up a load of white sheets, and she turned around, and the line promptly snapped and threw all the white sheets into the mud. She started to laugh and then just yelled out, "Hallelujah!" Just that was all she had to say. And the commotion was heard from the staff meeting room, and they all rushed out to help, laughing the whole time. And their cheerful attitude about the sheets changed her fate, and she was approved to go to the Congo as their new doctor, which is such a funny and strange and a story I would never want to live, but it worked out for the best, I guess. And in September of 1951, she headed out for Belgium to learn French, and she spent 8 months there and then another 3 doing deputations and saying goodbye to family and friends. And in February of 1953, at the age of 27, she was headed out for the Congo. A month later, she arrives in Ibambi in the northeastern tip of the Congo. And fun fact, this is also the place where C.T. Studd was buried in 1931, which makes sense because he started this mission under the name of Heart of Africa Mission. His son-in-law, Norman Grubb, is the one who ran it by the time that Helen joined. And I feel like you see his name kind of pop up in random areas during this time period. But Jack Scholes, who is the field director, picked her up and drove her to the mission, and the trees were decorated and welcome, and Jessie, who is Jack's wife, came out to greet her with a welcome home, dear, and there was singing and laughter, and she was welcomed as their child by an elder of the Congolese church there, and she felt very privileged by the occasion. The Scholes toured her around the mission dispensary, and she jotted down all the supplies they'd need, and the task seemed rather monumental, but the enthusiasm of the Scholes was contagious, and so she carried on. And it began to come all together. And a few months into ministering in Ibambi, one of their elderly church teachers was taken to the hospital with an obstruction and an immediate need for surgery. So the next day she goes to see him, and he has not had surgery. Instead, he was given a course of antibiotics. And she hears this story from one of his granddaughters. One of the male nurses had arrived the evening before, because most of the nurses here in the Congo are male, and he had offered the old man pills in exchange for a night with one of his teenage granddaughters who were staying with him in the hospital. And the old man said he'd rather die and then sent them away to stay with Christian relatives. And she talked to the Belgian doctor there, and he just kind of shrugged his shoulders to say, eh, I mean, what can you do? And there wasn't anything they could do because the next day the man died. And Helen refused to accept this as par for the course and vowed to have a Christian hospital run by Christian nurses where patients could hear the gospel and God's love for them. And that summer, she and other missionaries attended a conference where a massive revival broke out, both among the Congolese and the Europeans, and it continued to spread and made its way to Ebombi. And there was prayer and singing and confession of sin and amazing and renewed fellowship in the churches. They were hungry for God's word and would crowd in early before the services started to sing. In early 1954, Helen then attended this missions conference where she was asked alongside a co-worker, John Harris, to share their medical vision for the center. And John was most keenly interested in the welfare of the leprosy patients, and Helen was most interested in the training of national workers who would care for them. She wanted to train basically nurse evangelists, people who could care for both the physical and the spiritual needs of the patients. And the committee was mildly interested in the idea, but they really didn't much care for the idea of Christian nationals being trained as nurses because they felt that the primary duty should be evangelism and the church, and Helen thought that you could do both. They also felt that any medical mission should be run not from Ebombi, where everybody was and everything was, but from the derelict center in Nebobongo, which is about, or Nebobongo, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. But either way, it's 7 miles to the north. And Helen was staunchly against that, and nothing was decided just then, although the medical program moved ahead in Ebombi for the time being. And 8 students enrolled in the program, and most of them had maybe completed a couple years of primary school. One student, John Mongadima, had completed 1 year of post-secondary schooling, and later he would become a dear friend to Helen and her right-hand man. They officially opened the medical center in September of 1954 with 2 wards, 24 beds for women and 8 for men, with a veranda and a dispensary and a room for minor surgeries and another for special cases. It was whitewashed. It was beautiful.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
So the following year, 5 of her students were ready to take the state exams. 4 out of 5 of them passed and became state assistant nurses, and she considered it an amazing success, and it was. But success usually comes right before the gut punch. Maybe that's a little bit cynical, but this is usually how this works in cases like this. She takes a brief pause in the narrative to outline what a missionary is and what it is not, with a greater purpose that we'll see in a minute, but it's so good that I want to actually read it to you in its entirety. Said Christians often seem to have the impression that becoming a missionary is some form of metamorphosis by which a radical change of nature is achieved. Someone, possibly deeply stirred at a missionary meeting and challenged by the need of some less privileged people, feels constrained to offer for overseas service. Almost inevitably, this offering comes to be regarded as a holy call to a sacrificial vocation. The whole idea becomes wrapped in a veil of romantic splendor so that even the candidate may fail to observe the unreality of it all. The tendency of the congregation and friends, well nigh to hero worship, the missionary only increases the dilemma. Looking at the situation honestly and critically, many may know that mentally, physically, and spiritually, the candidate is unsuitable for missionary service. Some would-be candidates do not even have the burden of prayer for the peoples they hope to serve, nor have they ever sought to bring their immediate friends and neighbors in their own country to a knowledge of their friend and Savior Jesus Christ. Yet they vaguely hope that as soon as they board the steamer or plane to take them to a foreign land, something mystical will occur and transform them into their image of a missionary. And nothing can be further from the truth. I believe that, at its simplest, a missionary is one sent by God to live a Christian life, usually amongst people other than his own. It is the living which counts. This may include formal preaching, but it will certainly include personal relationships, and these often have to be worked out under the most trying conditions. For example, many missionaries discover that it is far from easy to adapt themselves to a completely different climate. The native foods may be hard, not only on the digestive system, but also on the aesthetic tastes. The language barrier may constitute a difficult problem, especially in the early years. And one cannot choose one's friends. Two missionaries of vastly different backgrounds, likes and dislikes may be thrown together for several years with no choice of other companionship. One is often expected to do jobs for which one is not trained and which may be actually distasteful. And yet in all of this, one is called upon to reveal Christ, to live a Christ-like life, to be a missionary. It is then that one realizes that it is not a journey on a steamer which changes one's nature. I did not escape from myself by going to the Congo. Rather, I came to know myself better, perhaps more as others had already seen me. The ordinary trials and frustrations of life that meet us all were just as real in the Congo, and in many ways were more pronounced as there were fewer ways of avoiding or circumventing them. For myself, it was only as I allowed the Lord to show me my own pettiness or willfulness or pride in different circumstances or problems that I became willing to let the Lord teach me of himself. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, the Lord said, for I am meek and lowly in heart. What happened in the 2 years following my first taste of success as a missionary doctor shows simply how very much I had to learn of him, for surely no one merited the description of Christlikeness less than I, if it was to involve the phrase meek and lowly in heart. So she says all of this and then proceeds to state that the committee had decided to move the medical mission to Dibabongo, and they decided they wanted her to move the same week. And why that was, there doesn't really seem to be a good reason, or at least Helen doesn't provide their reasoning. And she considered the whole thing thoughtless and thankless. They had already made significant progress on the medical mission there in Ebombi. So why move it and start all over? So she's spitting mad. She's determined to barge into the committee and speak her piece, and nobody and nothing can calm her down. She's thundering all over the mission. Jesse Scholes asks to pray with her, and she refuses. But eventually Jesse just kneels down and starts praying for her, and that takes all the wind out of Helen's sails, and before long she's calmed down. With a bit more time, she's decided not to fight it and to accept their decision. So what does this all mean? What's the next process here? The mission that she was going to go to had been abandoned by the Red Cross 10 years before, and it was mostly claimed by jungle again, and the only operational units are the maternity ward and the orphanage, so it's going to take a lot of work. And when she gets there, she's doing everything. She's overseeing all the paperwork, the building projects, the schooling of the orphans. And it sounds like maybe the nursing program was on pause to build the medical center, but it's kind of hard to say. And she also had to form good relationships with the local church, who were doubtful of her at first because they didn't know if she'd even stay. And she was overworked and stressed and irritable. And she received letters from other missionaries asking why she hadn't visited them, since she was the whole mission's doctor and not just Nibabongo's doctor. And she wrote back quippy and irritated responses, reminding them that they had sent her there, and she was up to her eyeballs in work, administrative, building, educational, and medical, while also operating as her own chauffeur and a grocery shopper, and she was the only one who could drive out to visit emergency patients. And just to give an idea of exactly how stressed and overworked she is, she gives this this snapshot. Here, she says, one Thursday, she ran an eye clinic at 9 a.m. and she saw a few patients, and she had finished up and cleared everything away and had prepared to head to the ward and do rounds. And in the afternoon, she was told that there was someone who would come to see her and get her eyes tested. And when she arrived, there was this little old woman waiting for her on her balcony. And she asked the woman where she had come from, and it was a nearby village. And so she gets mad at the woman and she says, next time, be on time. I'm going to turn you away. We're not doing your eyes today. Come back next week. And so she walks back inside to eat her lunch, totally not thinking about how she came across at all. But she says, shortly afterwards, John Mangadima came to see me. He was grieved and rebuked me for turning away the old lady. Could you not see that she was blind? She had waited all morning at the roadside for someone to come to lead her to the Christian doctor who heals people. She is a soul for whom Christ died, and you have harshly turned her away. Would he have done so? And since then, she says, I have always lifted my heart in a quick, silent prayer as I go to answer the door, that I may receive every visitor with whatever hour in his name and for his sake, showing his love and gentle kindliness and courtesy. Soon the reputation of the mission had grown so much that people were coming from as far as 400 miles away to be seen by the doctor, and the needs were so overwhelming everywhere they looked, and Helen refused to turn them away now. And again, she writes, it is easy for Christians at the home base to say that a missionary should not do too much and should take one day off in seven. In theory, we all agree, but when one is a doctor single-handed with no other medical help for 50 or even 150 miles in any direction, it is hard to put that into practice. how urgently every missionary society needs new recruits to share the workload. This would seem to be the only practical solution to this worldwide problem. Others argue that missions should not tackle institutional work, such as schools and hospitals, but leave these to the government. In our area and in many, many others, this would merely mean that thousands of children would have no schooling and thousands of patients would die each year. As the government just has not enough skilled and trained servants nor a sufficiently stable enough economy to begin to shoulder the whole of this vast responsibility, willing though they may be. A year and a half goes by and the medical mission is up and running, not perfectly and not without stress or mistakes, but Helen was managing it. And then it was decided once again by the committee that she ought to be uprooted and John Harris would come in and take over the mission, teaching her minor surgery, and then she would move south. So she needed to let go of everything that she'd built, and she found that to be really, really hard. And she had all these different ideas and things that she really wanted to work out, but she was no longer in charge of this mission. For example, she had this dream of seeing bush clinics set up every 14 miles in the northeastern province that could be run by national workers who could dispense daily care, and they would have oversight every 14 days with the church being gathered for prayer and evangelism, and the committee wasn't super keen on that idea either. And slowly, Helen began to grow more and more frustrated and embittered, especially against her fellow missionaries, who often scolded her for valuing her relationships with the Congolese too highly, creating an us versus them antagonism. And she said the whole thing could have been avoided if she had valued other people's giftings. She became cold once again and also doubted her salvation and felt like a failure. And surely she thought one so cold could not truly be born again. And one day, she was leading a Bible lesson that deeply moved her pupils, and she herself felt nothing. And she was so horrified that she was so unmoved by this that she rushed from her room to plead before God in her room to give her some feeling, some kind of emotion. And her pastor happened to be cycling by and heard all the commotion, and he offered to take her to his home village for the week so that she could refresh and seek the Lord. And when she went and spent the week with them, she had this massive breakthrough of revival and felt so renewed and reinvigorated. And as she cycled back, her senior nursing students rushed out to meet her and told her that they had been praying for her ever since the revival 4 years ago. And this is, in one way, it's really sweet, but also how humbling that must have been to know that your need for the joy of the Lord was so obvious that your nursing students were praying for you for 4 years. At this point, she had been working for 5 years with no breaks, but she finally got the mobile clinics that she wanted. There were 40 of them in a 400-mile loop, and she was due to go back on furlough soon as her mom was not doing well, but first she was finishing up the writing of a Swahili medical textbook for the nursing students to use, in addition to everything else she was doing, which now included a medical circuit through each of the bush clinics. And then finally she arrives back in England, and immediately she has to go to the hospital for 5 weeks with dysentery and appendicitis. And after that, she spends 10 weeks traveling around on a deputation that she thought was amazing. That sounds awful to me after spending 5 weeks in a hospital. But she was a busy bee, because then after that, she worked at a Christian hospital during a flu epidemic. But during all this, she began to feel very lonely as a single woman missionary, and she felt looked down upon, as she should have been married already, because at this point, she's getting up there. And so she was determined to catch herself a man. And she did find a man, but this guy didn't want to go to the Congo. And she was like, well, I guess I can give up the Congo. I mean, what's more important, really? And so she fought the Lord for this guy until the bitter end. But finally, she gave it up to the Lord and realized that he had not seen fit to give her a man for whatever reason. And so she needed to be content with that. And the remainder of her time in England was spent working as an acting registrar of a hospital, which would come in handy for training Congolese personnel and administration in the future independent Congo, which was just around the corner. And her coworkers were really sweet, and as a going-away gift, they actually pulled together and bought her a general anesthesia machine to take back. And she set sail and heads back about 6 weeks before the country would declare its independence. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds of the independence movement and all the aftermath, because it really is a proxy war, or becomes a proxy war, between the U.S. and the Soviets, with other countries siding on one side or the other. And it's this anti-colonial sentiment that had been building steadily through the 1950s, about 40 years after Belgium took over. And if you know much about their treatment of the country, you would understand why. And if you don't know much about that, then I recommend the Stanley episodes I did, part 3 specifically And then Mariah Fearing as well. So if you want to get a little background on that, go ahead, I'll link those. But a Soviet-friendly leader named Patrice Lumumba was becoming very popular among the nationalists. And after a 1959 riot in Leopoldville, Belgium decided it was just time to give up. They didn't care anymore, and they were just going to pull out. But there was no transitionary government, no preparation, and so this leaves a power vacuum, as you can imagine. Lumumba becomes prime minister, and then there's this complication because the Congo, the whole reason that Belgium wanted the Congo is because it was rich in resources, one of those resources being uranium, which you can use to make nuclear weapons. Now, in the era of the Cold War, uranium and nuclear weapons are very, very important. So the Soviets obviously wanted the access to the uranium, and Belgium actually tried to hold on to these resources. They're like, we'll give you independence, just give us the resources. And they're like, no. But there's a whole thing about the CIA involvement in Lumumba's assassination. And the new guy they put in is backed by the Western powers, and this instability gave rise to the Simba Rebellion. Simba, as we know from The Lion King, means lion in Swahili. And so you have this weird connection with them because they were kind of like these Soviets, but also Maoists, but also they really weren't either of those things. They were mostly traditional, and they had all the traditional beliefs, including this thing called Dawa, which is where if you had water repeatedly applied to you by a medicine man, then you became invincible to bullets. And I guess this was actually kind of common around this area. So, yeah, but it's obviously not true. That's what they thought. So they were supported by the party of Lumumba, and they were disorganized and undersupplied and undisciplined. But they did receive aid from China and from the Soviets, as well as the Cubans, who sent Che Guevara to train their troops in the eastern part of the country. And the Congolese military, you can't say for certain, but it seems like maybe they were a little bit sympathetic to the rebel cause because they really didn't try to stop them. For example, at Stanleyville, where kind of the turning point of this rebellion was, the national troops just kind of left. They didn't put up a fight. They had way more people on their side than the Simba rebels did, but they just kind of left and said, oh, we were scared of them because they have the medicine man behind them or whatever. But they just left behind a bunch of weapons and vehicles, which was a turning point in the rebellion. After this, they began massacring and brutalizing Catholic priests and nuns and Protestants. They began taking hostages, and so Western mercenaries were hired to put an end to it, and they did. The Simbas are all but crushed in 1965, with the remainder going into exile, but they weren't completely gone because a former Simba named Kabila overthrew their president in 1997, and then he held on to power until he was assassinated in 2001, and then that guy's son took over and served as president until 2019, and thus you have a very brief history of the Congolese independence movement. Now, the region was already preparing for political upheaval, and refugees were flooding across the border of neighboring countries, and Helen's warned to turn back, but she continues on and arrives safely. And she'd be taking over for John Harris and his family, who had been in country for about 7 years, and they were in desperate need of a break, and Helen was happy to get back to work. And if you're kind of confused a little bit why she is still in Ibobongo, it's because the dream to kind of have her go south just never materialized, and so she's still at the place that she wanted to be. So one evening, there is a meeting of the station elders and male nurses, and they sent for the four white missionaries, and she could tell they were leading up to something. And so it turns out they wanted an African leader, because everywhere else, everyone else had done it, and they wanted to appoint John Mongadima. And they didn't know what to say, these missionaries, but they silently prayed for wisdom. But John saved them by saying that he didn't mind overseeing the nurses or taking over the administrative work, but he wasn't a doctor and he couldn't do without the doctors and he didn't want to be over them. So there was this collective outpouring of relief because they hadn't denied the request or even pushed back. And this marathon included a lot of growing pains. On June 30th, the official day of independence, they were met with cheers and celebration, but no violence. And so the tensions eased a little bit because everyone was really nervous. And then they heard of an army mutiny in Leopoldville, which is Kinshasa today, which is on the other side of the country from where they were at. And the Belgian families had to rush to get out, and several of their women were raped, and other Western women were raped as well. And all the missionaries gathered at Ibambi to decide what to do. And everyone had a story to tell about the things they had experienced or seen. And while they were meeting, these truckloads of soldiers went by singing about what they would do to them when they came back. And most of them agreed to go over the border and wait for things to calm down. the border being either Sudan or Uganda. But Helen decided not to go, as she returned back to the mission, not feeling led to leave. And two local ladies were worried about her, and they came to spend the night with her after they said the Lord had woken them up and told them to go to her so she wouldn't be alone. And the next day, these two missionary ladies came from their other mission 40 miles away, and they sat talking about the events which had led the others to leave and decided that the final straw had been the rape of the women by the mutineering army. And in reflection, she writes, "Surely the Lord has died on Calvary for this as much as any other sin. It wasn't our sin or shame. We could remain pure before the Lord with his purity no matter what happened. 50 years ago, missionaries risked their lives from malaria or wild animals, and today it might be a different price they had to pay, a different danger to face, but surely he was still the same wonderful Lord who was worthy of any sacrifice made." 4 weeks later, the other missionaries returned, but the situation was deteriorating, especially after the assassination of Lumumba, and racial tensions increased tenfold and even began to affect the churches. One evening, Helen and the other staff were disturbed to hear and then see a bunch of their midwives and pupils dressed in traditional garb, and they were dancing around singing in the native tongue these vulgar things in the tune of hymns and mocking the expressive nature of revivals while making fun of God and the missionaries. And the Christians were equal parts horrified, disgusted, and also filled with this deep sense of failure, because what had they done wrong with these girls? And they had to close the maternity ward and then dismiss all the girls. And they heard that within 5 months, more than half of the girls were pregnant. And Helen was saddened to learn that this was what liberation meant to them. That's all it meant to them, was throwing out all of discipline and morality. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, but in the midst of all this, they have a minor smallpox outbreak, and someone attempted to poison her food, but the dog ate it instead and was dead by the morning. And then she was sick for 3 months and almost died, and the political and racial tensions continued to increase, with threats of violence or actual violence being perpetrated against anybody who had either worked for the colonial government or was suspected of being a neo-colonialist or anyone sympathetic to the colonial movement. And the worst thing that could happen is someone accuse you of being a neo-colonialist. And early 1964 saw more unrest, looting, rioting in the southern part of the country. This unrest affected their area as well up in the north. The entire country experienced supply shortages and massive inflation. And in July 1964, the WEC held a conference attended by all their missionaries and two representatives from each of the local church councils. And Helen wrote that it was a wonderful time of prayer and Bible study, discussing projects for the next 3 years, bonding together in unity and in purpose, breaking down barriers which had been caused by the upheaval, and they all left with renewed vision and purpose, and they didn't realize that many of them would never meet again in the same way, because within 6 months, 4 of those missionaries were dead and the rest had been pushed out of the country, while communication from their friends and the local churches would become virtually non-existent. 1 month later, Stanleyville fell to the Simba rebels without a fight, and the missionaries in Nibobongo and Ibambi, 500 kilometers away, weren't overly concerned because war rumors and fighting had been nearly constant after all. But 8 days later, the missionaries at Nibobongo were under occupation, and they had put spies in the men's ward, and they also came and went as they pleased. And you just never knew if they were coming to visit a friend or they had ulterior motives. And Hella describes it as a war on the nerves. You had to be careful about every single thing you said at all times. And then at the end of October in 1964, things took a sharp turn. She was at home asleep in the early hours of the morning when she was awoken by the sound of banging on her front door. The Simba rebels were demanding entry, and she had no choice but to let them in. They swarmed in, demanding the man of the house and pocketing everything their eyes saw and their hearts wanted. And they started to go when their lieutenant demanded that Helen go into her bedroom. And she took off running outside in the mud, and they caught her and dragged her back, beating her the whole way. Her glasses were gone and her tooth was broken. Her mouth was filled with sticky blood as she was dragged back into her bedroom. And then soon afterwards, she and 19 other women and children were gathered up and driven away as hostages. And 6 weeks later, Helen found herself at a convent comforting a young woman who had been raped, and as a result, she had lost her sanity or was losing her sanity, and thought that she had broken her vow of chastity and was now headed for eternal damnation. She records her conversation with the woman. She says, "Can you take this sin of cruel man against your flesh for his sake, as Mary took the world's condemnation? You have not sinned, God forbid. It isn't our sin. They've sinned against us, yes, but we are only the bodies for the Savior to indwell. You haven't lost your purity. Rubbish. We've never had any anyway. All our self-righteousness is as dirty rags in God's holy sight. But if we have him who is all pure indwelling in us, their wickedness cannot touch us nor sully his purity. And the nun asked, why her? Why was she taken twice? Why couldn't it have been another? And Helen comforted her by saying that she had protected another. Perhaps because you were taken twice, another was not taken once. And she said she was brought face to face with her own offered wisdom and reasoning on Christmas Day. They were once again moved, this time to a house in the middle of nowhere. And three or four young guards swaggered up, and one reached out to take a young woman. And Jessie Scholes, the wife of their field director, jumped in to protect this younger woman and almost earned the butt end of a rifle in the face before this younger woman leapt up, offering to go and to go with him to save Mrs. Scholes. And another guard dragged away another young woman as Helen shrank further behind a couch. And her conscience was taunting her with words that she had given to the young nun, so it was good enough for her but not for you. And she was reminded that everyone in this room except for her was so far untouched. So then she offered to go with the last guard. And she came back later just wishing they would kill them and just get it over with. And she watched one girl come back in, and then the last one, whom she drew down to herself and comforted her until the girl fell asleep from exhaustion. And on New Year's Eve, they heard the distant rumblings of gunfire that was growing rapidly closer. Their soldiers rushed about engaging in a firefight with whoever was outside. Would they be killed? Would the soldiers fire on them from the windows? They had no idea. But soon the door burst open and the room began to fill with these white soldiers, these mercenaries I had mentioned earlier. And they comforted the women and told them they were safe and took them out of the house and on the way back to safety. And now she was back in England, and she said it was 10 weeks before she began to come out of her dazed stupor and to realize that life existed in the present tense and there were still things to be done. She then went on a four-week holiday with her mother and sister in Cornwall, mainly sleeping, eating, resting, reading, and thanking God for his goodness to her. She spent the next 6 months touring the British Isles, speaking at 200-plus meetings, telling of the grace of Jesus, and asking people to pray for the people and the churches in the Congo. And they had no idea what was happening with the churches there until finally a series of letters began pouring in. They had lost everything and said they were as destitute as they were before the missionaries came more than 50 years before. But they had the most important thing of all, and that was their salvation. And they pleaded with the missionaries to return to them as soon as it was safe so they could have fellowship with them once again. Their fellow believers were starting off from scratch. They had absolutely nothing. Everything they had worked so hard to build needed to be rebuilt, and they needed help. They couldn't do it on their own. And so the hearts of many of the missionaries were stirred again to return, and they submitted their applications to be permitted to return, Helen included among this number. And this begs the question of, why did she return? What was driving her to do that after all the horrible things that she had experienced? She spent 5 months in captivity. Why would she want to return, especially so soon? I mean, this was, by the time she actually goes back, it's about a year after all that had happened. But she reflected that had she known the difficulties the second trip would stir up, she may well have decided not to go back. But I don't think that's necessarily true, because as she reflects, she demonstrates her eyes wide open approach. The winds could change again. There was a lot of anti-colonial sentiment that could be reignited with a spark. She shuddered at the prospect of starting over from scratch. Was it worth it? And it was for the love and camaraderie that she shared with the believers that she eventually went back. Her pastor wrote to her, and close friends like John Mongadima wrote how much they wished to see her and work together again. Specifically, John wrote that he understood that it would take time to heal from all the things that his people had done to her. But if God should persuade her, he will never cease to thank him and to love and care for her like never before. Even the mercenary commander who rescued them wrote to others, the needs of the people are so overwhelming that they were prepared to accept responsibility for safeguarding the mission and the missionaries as they began the work of rehabilitation. And a former student wrote and begged Helen, telling her not to hold the suffering against them, to come back to them, please. As much as God enables them, they would see to it that it would never happen again. And the senior workman provided her an update on her home, which had been riddled with machine gun fire. He said that he could have it ready in 2 months and would work without wages because they all love her and want her back. So hearing all of that, it's easier to understand why she went back, even though in the light of all that had happened before. Now, the story could easily be left here, but that wouldn't be entirely truthful because she does indeed become a well-sought-after speaker in her later life. But before that, she returns in 1966 and helps establish a 250-bed hospital, maternity ward, training college for doctors, and a center for leprosy. But she left again in 1973 after being pushed out by her fellow students and staff after they thought she was being dishonest about getting official government acceptance for the school. It was actually just a really slow process. But these many things had begun to fester, and she was no longer respected by her students. She had been removed from the classroom and asked to resign by both her staff and the board after the staff's lack of confidence in her leadership was shared. And there were still influences of the Simba rebels, with the students revealing their true feelings in moments of anger and rebellion. And repeating a very similar pattern as what has happened to her basically the entire time she's been doing ministry, she was pushed out after they had received government acceptance, something she'd worked so hard for, jumping through all the hoops for years. And it reminded me of what had happened to her after her nursing program was successful, and then she was shoved out to Nibabongo and then asked to rebuild it, and then once it was rebuilt, they tried to pass it off to another person, but obviously that didn't happen. And that just seemed to be, a Helen's fate in ministry. And reading her accounts, and even though she was so gracious and accepting much of the time, I just kind of got angry for her because it just didn't seem fair. And in the end of part two of her story in He Gave Us a Valley, she titles the last chapter, Was It All Worthwhile? In her last week in the Congo, she had officially handed over the hospital to new hands, and her Congolese friends threw a goodbye party for her. More than 60 people, friends she had known for the past 7 years or longer, upwards of 20, gathered to say goodbye. The gardeners, the maintenance guys, the cooks, the teaching staff, the nurses, the church elders, the choir members. The floor was open for anyone who wanted to say something. And for 2 hours, they spoke and she cried. And her mind wandered to all the people she had trained and known and who were now doing important ministries throughout the country. And she kept mentally ticking off their names, and the list just kept growing. Nurses and medical workers, church elders and pastors. Among those, she had several close friends, too many to name. She says she realized, as perhaps never before, how much she loved them and was going to miss them. As the evening died down and she went back to her little house on the hill, she says, I suddenly knew with every fiber of my being that these 20 years had been very worthwhile, very, very worthwhile, utterly worthwhile, with no room left for regrets or recriminations. As always, thank you for listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.